Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm Robert Diab, an associate professor in the Faculty of Law at Thompson Rivers University and a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Bruce Baugh of Thompson Rivers University about his new book, Existential Monday, Philosophical Essays, which is a translation of a collection of writings of the Romanian philosopher Benjamin Fondan, who lived in Paris from roughly the 1920s to the mid-40s. The book was published by the New York Review of Books in 2016. Although Fondan has until now been better known as a poet, his contributions to existential thought in the 1930s and 40s have been gaining wider attention in recent years. His work bears relevance to contemporary debates in critical theory by anticipating some of its central concerns and preoccupations, including the critique of reason and of the subject, and thought that grapples with the ineffable or the impossible. Fondan's principal interlocutors included the Russian religious existentialist Lev Shestov, Albert Camus, and Soren Kierkegaard. Central themes in his thinking relate to the limits of logic or rationality, the primacy of individual experience, and the insights to be gained from paradoxes at the heart of certain religious texts. Professor Baugh's work on Fondan will be of interest to a wide variety of readers seeking a better understanding of a thinker whose work invites consideration alongside his better-known contemporaries, Walter Benjamin and the early Levinas, among others. Bruce, welcome to the show. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks very much, Robert, and thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was born in Esterhazy, Saskatchewan, which is the middle Canadian prairie province. And my mother was an elementary school teacher, and my father was a journalist. I ended up being raised in North Vancouver. And when I was in high school, in grade 8, when I was about 14 years old, I had an English teacher, Kenneth Hegler, and he gave me two books to read, which were not on the syllabus. One was 1984 by George Orwell, and the other one was The Outsider or The Stranger by Albert Camus. And both of those books I found absolutely fascinating. Neither of them I fully understood at the time, but both of them got me thinking, in political terms with Orwell and got me thinking in existential terms with Camus. And that really launched my entire intellectual trajectory.
And then you you went to university to study philosophy?
I did. I went to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver to study philosophy, and got absolutely hooked. I took as many courses as I could. But on the other hand, I was disappointed with the kind of philosophy that was being taught there at the time. This was the early to mid-1970s, and the prevailing school of philosophical thought at UBC was a variant of a logical positivism, particularly the British version. A lot of the professors had been trained at Oxford under philosophers like A.J. Eyre and J.L. Austin. So there was a lot of kind of logical empiricism and philosophy of language, ordinary language philosophy, as it was called at the time. and nothing, you know, virtually nothing about the existential philosophers that I was really interested in. I was able to take one course on Sartre's philosophy, which was great. We did Being and Nothingness, which is a big and difficult book. And one course on Edmund Husserl, the founder of phenomenology. We studied his Cartesian meditations. And so that was great. I mean, that sort of gave me an insight into what phenomenology was all about. But beyond that, there was really nothing. And I found that, you know, quite disappointing. And I did my master's at UBC, and of course, it was more of the same. It wasn't until I did my PhD at the University of Toronto that I was actually able to study some of these philosophers whom I found, you know, so interesting. Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Martin Heidegger, Sartre again, Jean-Paul Sartre. And, you know, I did my thesis on Heidegger and Sartre and the idea of authenticity. And reading some of the people who had really grabbed my attention as an undergraduate, but doing so, you know, at a higher level and in a more in-depth kind of study, people like Soren Kierkegaard and Friedrich Nietzsche. So that's when things got started in a serious way for me.
And at that time, you had gained an awareness of the kind of larger network of figures in the 30s who were contributing to existentialism. But my understanding is that you had not yet discovered Fondane at that time.
I hadn't discovered Fondane at that time. It wasn't until I finished my PhD and I was doing postdoctoral research in Paris that I discovered Fondane. I was doing research on Sartre's theory of history, and Sartre's theory of history is very much influenced by Hegel, the German philosopher Hegel. So I was doing research into the reception of Hegel's philosophy in France during the 1930s and 40s. I came across a book by a French Marxist philosopher and sociologist, Henri Lefebvre, who's probably most well-known these days for his critique of everyday life. And in the 1930s, he was the leading French Marxist intellectual, very much a Hegelian Marxist. And he wrote a book on existentialism that was published in 1946. And it's not a very serious book. It was pretty much a book commissioned by the Communist Party of France in order to discredit existentialism. So he had a lot of nasty things to say about Sartre and nasty things to say about Camus. But he really, really despised Sartre. And he kept contrasting Sartre to this other fellow, Benjamin Fondane. And he said, you know, that Sartre was a phony and just a poseur, whereas Fondane was somebody who actually lived his existential philosophy and took it to the limit. And I was intrigued because I thought, well, who is this person? And he mentioned a book by Fondane called The Unhappy Consciousness. So I checked that out and I started reading it. And I was quite blown away. On the one hand, I was bewildered because this was a completely different style of philosophy. It was utterly unlike Heidegger and Sartre and any of the other people I was used to. And on the other hand, and maybe because it was so off the beaten track, its ideas were very radical, very challenging, much more radical than anything in the academic existentialist I'd been studying up to that point.
So, Bruce, just to make clear, after your PhD, you then specialized in Sartre, and but also in French philosophy of the 20th century. You've written a book on the French Hegel, and you were an editor of a journal of Sartre studies, and that it's a little later that you then come back to Fondane. Can you tell us a bit about your thinking about the decision to do this book?
Right. Well, I did write about Fondane, half a chapter on Fondane in my book, French Hegel, From Surrealism to Postmodernism. So, you know, I did fit him into that survey, and I talked about a whole lot of other people in that book, the surrealists, the French Marxists of the 30s and 40s, Georges Bataille, Sartre, Derrida, Gilles Deleuze, Michel Foucault. It was kind of a survey of French philosophers who engaged with Hegel in one way or another from about 1900 to, 2000. That was going to be about it for Fondane, but the book came out and I got a letter from a woman, Monique Joutrin, who lives in Israel and is the president of the Society for Benjamin Fondane Studies. And she invited me to a seminar or a colloquium that takes place in a village, and it really is a village, it's tiny, in the French Alps called Peyresque. So you go to Nice, and then from Nice you have to take a train to a place called Adnot, and then from there you have to get a taxi at this very winding, and I do mean winding, mountain road, and then you're into this village that had fallen into ruins until it was restored by some Belgian hikers and mountaineers after the Second World War. And it's now become a site for all of these academic conferences. So I went to this conference, and there were people there who studied Fondane from Israel, from Romania, from France, from Switzerland, from Belgium, from the United Kingdom, from the United States, and Germany. So there's this international gathering, and this was quite exciting. And it really gave me a completely different angle on Fondane's philosophy. For one thing, I've been considering Fondane as a philosopher, solely as a philosopher. But most of the people at this symposium were interested in Fondane as a poet. And certainly posthumously, Fondane has become much more famous as a poet than as a philosopher. One of his poems in particular, Exodus, which is about the French defeat in 1940 and the hordes of people fleeing, along the roads from the advancing German armies. This poem about the French defeat has become, very famous, and an excerpt of it is at the, Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem. And that's the angle that most of the people at the conference were coming at Fondane from. I had a different, more philosophical perspective, the discussions were great, and I returned again in 2007 and 2008, and it was those discussions with these other Fondane scholars which prompted me to translate Fondane's philosophical work into English. And the book, it's very short. I mean, we only have, very few pieces by Fondane in the book, but I'm hoping that this will be the start of other translations, other books.
Okay, can you tell us a bit about who he was and why you think he's relevant? He's just an interesting figure to be revisiting at this point in time.
Well, Fondane was Romanian, as you mentioned in the introduction, a Romanian Jew. Fondane is actually a pseudonym. His birth last name was Wexler, or Wexler. He grew up in a small town in Moldavia. Then he was in the major city of Moldavia called Iași or Jassy. Went to Bucharest, the capital, supposedly to study law. That's what his family had in mind for him. But when he was in Bucharest, he actually spent most of his time writing for avant-garde literary journals. He was very interested in French symbolism. Baudelaire, Rimbaud, those poets were really his touchstones. Mallarmé, he knew very well. He knew his poetry very well, although he didn't like it. He was also caught up in, the emerging literary trends like Dadaism. There were a lot of Romanian Dadaists, Tristan Tzara being the most famous, and Surrealism, when it was getting started. And so he was writing literary criticism. He was writing his own poetry. He was writing essays. He also founded a theater company, kind of an avant-garde or experimental theater company called The Island. and they put on a few productions in Bucharest. That wasn't entirely successful on a number of levels. The theater company didn't last very long. It was probably too avant-garde for the general public in Bucharest. And there was also the problem of anti-Semitism. You know, Fondan was a Jew, and there's pretty significant anti-Semitism both amongst the wider public and amongst official circles, which made it difficult for him as an author in Romania. The other thing was that his touchstones, as I said, were French. You know, it was French literature. He regarded Romanian literature as a colony of French literature. So he decided to leave the colony and go to the motherland. In 1923, he went to Paris and tried to establish himself there as a writer, continued to write for the avant-garde periodicals in Bucharest. He was their Paris correspondent, and tried to get jobs, had a lot of difficulty in doing so, and went through some pretty tough years in the 1920s as he was trying to find his feet in France.
And so then he moves to France.
He's kind of scrambling around, doing this and that. He keeps on writing. But at a certain point, he stops writing poetry in Romanian. He's going to become a French poet. He starts writing in French. So he goes through this transition, and it's also a bit of a personal crisis. And he also, at this time, in the mid-1920s, meets a Russian philosopher who had emigrated to Paris, Lev Shestov. So there's an evening, a party at somebody's house. He meets this guy, Shestov. They correspond a bit, but nothing much comes of it until, I guess 1928 or so. The two of them start seeing each other and start corresponding more frequently. And Fondan takes a serious interest in Shestov's work and sees Shestov's philosophy as being, you know, the key, you know, the foundation that he himself is going to build on in his own philosophy. And then he starts publishing philosophical essays. They start coming out in 1929. The first ones are on Shestov and on Edmund Husserl, the phenomenologist. The one on Shestov is laudatory, as you might expect, and the one on Husserl is extremely critical, because Husserl represents for Fondan and for Shestov this kind of rationalist tendency in philosophy that everything is going to be based on reason, on logic, on rational categories, and to those rational categories they oppose the existential categories of the individual living human being. That's something that they say that logic and science simply cannot capture. So that really marks the beginning of his philosophical career. But he didn't have any training in philosophy, something that he emphasized time and again. And he was very modest about his philosophical abilities, you know, diffident even. But Shestov kept on encouraging him. Shestov said, you know, you're a philosopher. You came to philosophy, you know, by different routes, you know, compared to the ordinary, right? You didn't study it in university, you know, you're not an academic, but you are a philosopher. You understand these ideas and you have a very sharp critical mind. You're very good at taking apart other people's ideas, which I think is true. That's probably the strongest side of Fondan's philosophy, is the critical side. And so, you know, Fondan, you know, he kept going. He published in the same year a major poem called Ulysses, which was his reworking of the Odyssey. He has a modern Ulysses, you know, like James Joyce. His Ulysses is a modern Ulysses, but it's not Leopold Bloom. Although Fondan's Ulysses, like Joyce's, is also Jewish. There's one line in the poem, Ulysses, you're a Jew. Naturally, you're a Jew. And he published a book about Rimbaud, Rambaud le Voyou. I keep looking for an adequate translation of Voyou. It means something like a street tough or a hooligan, a rough character. So he publishes this book on Rambaud, which is very influenced by Shestov's philosophy, although it is a critical study of Rambaud's poetry. So that's 1933, and that's, you know, what really launches him in France. And in the meantime, he's also found a steady job. He's working at an insurance company, the B Insurance Company, or the Abbé Insurance Company. And that's where he meets the woman who becomes his wife, Geneviève Tissier, who becomes Geneviève Fondin. So the two of them get married in 1931. And he starts, you know, settling in, you know, the insurance company job, you know, that comes to an end. And then he becomes a screenwriter for Paramount, a French Paramount, and also, you know, kind of an assistant director and general factotum for Paramount Studios. He was always living kind of hand to mouth. You know, these jobs were precarious and they weren't very well paid, and they were, you know, subsidizing really his career as a writer, as a poet and an essayist and a philosopher. And Geneviève, she had steady employment, so she was really subsidizing her husband's career.
Now, before we go in further detail about the philosophical work that he was doing in the 30s, there was an interesting interlude where he meets a woman from Argentina and travels there.
That's right. So that's when he meets Victoria Ocampo. And I think it was actually at an evening at Ocampo's that he met Shestov. So he meets Victoria Ocampo, and she is the editor of a literary review in Argentina called Sud. I'm not sure about the pronunciation. I'm giving it a French pronunciation, but it means no, it's not Sud. It's Sur, S-U-R. And she's friends with Borges and Kaiserlinck and all of these literary figures of the 20s and 30s. She sort of knows anybody who's anybody in South America and in Europe, all kinds of people. She later knows Camus, Henry Miller, all kinds of people. And she's really taken with Fondin, and she invites him to Argentina to give a series of lectures. So he gives two kinds of lectures. He gives a lecture on Shestov's philosophy at the university in Buenos Aires. And he also gives a presentation of some surrealist films. Okay, these are early surrealist films. There's Salvador Dali and Luis Buñuel's The Andalusian Dog. He shows that. There's the Seashell and the Clergyman. There's the L'Âge d'Or, The Golden Age. It's another Buñuel surrealist film. So some of the very early surrealist films from the late 1920s and early 1930s, he gives a presentation of those films to an Argentine audience and explains their significance, what he takes to be their significance. And the friendship that develops between Ocampo and Fondin, between Victoria Ocampo and Fondin, is a strong and long-lasting one. She visited Fondin in 1939, just before the outbreak of the war. And she was a woman of means, and so, you know, I guess she had hired the taxi and dropped off Fondin at his place in Paris. And Fondin, as he's getting out of the car, says, you know, wait for a minute, I've got something for you. And he goes into his apartment, he comes back out, and he hands her this thick envelope, stuffed with papers. And he says, I want you to take this to Argentina for safekeeping, because he knew that war was imminent. And he said to Victoria, this is the most precious thing that I possess. And what, in fact, it was his transcription of interviews he had conducted with Lev Shestov during the course of the 1930s, as well as an essay of his introducing Shestov's philosophy. So Ocampo did take that with her to Argentina, and these interviews were published not until the 1960s.
Bruce, can you situate both Shestov and Fondane for us in the existentialism of the 30s? You say in your terrific introduction that in addition to the secular existentialists, there were Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish existentialists, religious existentialists. There was a broad network of these figures. So where do Shestov and Fondane fit in to this bigger picture?
I guess the first thing I would say is that they fit in by not fitting in.
Okay.
I mean, they really don't fit into any of the categories. So, you know, if we're looking at Jewish existentialists, then, you know, Emmanuel Levinas, you know, at the time, I think you could call him, you know, safely enough, you know, some kind of existentialist, very much influenced by Martin Heidegger, at least in the early 1930s. And I think after that as well. And Franz Rosenzweig, you know, who's very much influenced by Kierkegaard, and Martin Buber. You know, so these are prominent Jewish philosophers who are also in one way or another existentialists. Levinas wrote a review of a book that Shestov wrote about Kierkegaard's philosophy. And he said about Shestov, he says, well, you know, Shestov's the philosopher who is a Jew, but he's not really a Jewish philosopher. That is, he didn't see Shestov's thought as representing this current of Jewish thinking that goes, you know, all the way back to the Bible and ancient times. Fondane sees things quite differently. Fondane thinks that Shestov is, in fact, the authentic voice of Jewish thought, the authentic voice of, you know, a philosophy that is first expressed in the Bible. But Fondane, like Shestov, thinks that that authentic Judaism was lost around the time of the destruction of the temple, you know, in the year 70. And it was already on its way to being lost because of Hellenizing influences on Jewish thought. That is to say that Jewish thought became influenced by Greek philosophy. And for Shestov and Fondane, it becomes infected by Greek philosophy, corrupted by Greek philosophy. So one of the books that Shestov wrote, it was his last book, it was called Athens or Jerusalem. So you can have one. You can have Athens and Greek philosophy, the tradition of logic and reason as being the basis of philosophy, or you can have Jerusalem, which is based on, you know, a God who reveals himself in history and a God who is actually all-powerful. He is not constrained by the laws of nature because he made the laws of nature. Similarly, he's not constrained by the laws of logic because he made those too. So if God wants to do something that's logically contradictory, he can. You know, for God, all things are possible, including the logically impossible. So Shestov thinks that that is the real Jewish thought, especially as expressed in the book of Genesis, and Fondane follows them in that. So they are outsiders with respect to Jewish philosophy and Jewish existentialism. They're very much in dialogue with it. Shestov was friends with Martin Buber. You know, the two of them had many, many conversations, but they didn't agree on very much philosophically. Now, the Protestant existentialists, these are people who are largely forgotten right now. But, you know, in Germany, you have Karl Barth, B-A-R-T-H, and he's very much influenced by Kierkegaard. And in France, you have Protestants like Denis de Rougemont, who's probably most famous for his book, Love in the Western World. And later on, you have Paul Ricoeur, you know, so you have those people. And then for, you know, the kind of Catholic existentialism, there's Gabriel Marcel. And Marcel, you know, his style of philosophy in a lot of ways is closer to Fondin's than it is to, say, you know, Sartre's or Heidegger's. It's much more personal, much more individual, less academic, less, quote, scientific. And so you've got all these different currents. And I should mention one other figure, and that's Jean Val, W-A-H-L, who was the leading Kierkegaard interpreter in France in the 1930s. And he's kind of close to people like, you know, Ricoeur in terms of his approach to Kierkegaard. He's personal friends with Gabriel Marcel, and he's also very much influenced by Heidegger. So he has a philosophy which is kind of halfway between this very personal, individualistic style of Fondin and Gabriel Marcel and the more academic, phenomenological styles of Martin Heidegger, Edmund Husserl. He's trying to walk the line between those two. So there are these debates amongst all of these different figures. In the middle of the 1930s in particular, there was a ferocious debate about Kierkegaard, how to read Kierkegaard, how to interpret him for Shestov and Fondin, especially for Fondin. The only way to properly read and appreciate Kierkegaard is to interpret him personally. Like, you have to relate what he's writing to your own personal life. And Kierkegaard's famous book, Fear and Trembling, about Abraham and Isaac, Abraham going to sacrifice Isaac, and, you know, how can you commit murder? How can you murder your own son? That seems to go contrary to every ethical law. And Kierkegaard talks about this teleological suspension of the ethical in the name of some higher religious ideal of faith. And Fondin says, well, you know, everybody has his own Isaac. Everybody carries his own Isaac within himself. So you have to find, you know, what for you is that Isaac? What for you would represent this ultimate sacrifice for faith, and in the name of the absurd, right? I mean, there's nothing that can rationally justify such an action. So for him, you have to take it personally. And he writes an essay that lambastes Jean Val for taking it academically and looking at Kierkegaard, you know, from the outside rather than jumping into his philosophy. And he gets into debates with Denis de Rougemont and other people at the same time. So it's very lively and it's very heated. So that's one sort of context of debate that's happening within the existentialist camp itself. And as for, you know, somebody like Jean-Paul Sartre, I mean, he's writing his first essays in the middle of the 1930s, you know, like his short essay, The Transcendence of the Ego, and his Sketch for a Theory of Emotions comes out in 1939. But Sartre is really an unknown. I mean, he's published, you know, short stories in La Nouvelle Revue Française, which is the top, you know, literary and intellectual journal. So people know him for that and for his novel Nausea. But he's not really known as a philosopher. He hasn't come on the scene yet. And Albert Camus, the same thing. I mean, Camus doesn't publish anything until, you know, 1942. That's when The Stranger, The Outsider comes out. And then 1943, The Myth of Sisyphus. So existentialism in the 1930s is a very different animal from what it becomes after the Second World War, when people like Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Camus and Maurice Merleau-Ponty come into prominence.
So, but to step back a moment, so in the mid to late 30s, Fondin starts to write more philosophy. It starts to take up more of his time. And he also begins to gain traction in certain circles, to the point where Shestov's translator says to Shestov at some point, it may be that your philosophy, Shestov, will become best known through the vehicle of Fondin's discussion of it. So talk a bit about Fondin's philosophy once it develops. Where does he take both Kierkegaard and Shestov's ideas? And what is Fondin's unique contribution to existentialism?
Okay, well, there are quite a few things to say about that. One, going back to the remark by Shestov's translator, the guy who translated Shestov into French, Boris de Schleutzer, Fondin was a leading exponent of Chestov's philosophy in France. His books outsold Chestov. So, you know, the interpreter, the disciple was better known than the master. This, you know, kind of intrigued and I think irked Chestov a little bit. So what did Fondin have that Chestov didn't? Well, for one thing, he had a literary sensibility, like his book on, you know, Rimbaud. So, you know, there he's taking on one of the big French poets. I mean, everybody in France knows and has read Rimbaud. You know, that's going to have a lot more appeal to a French readership. And the other thing that Fondin does is that he really engages with the new philosophers that are coming on the scene. Now, Chestov had also written about Husserl, as Fondin did, but Fondin writes about Heidegger. And Fondin's essay on Heidegger, when it came out in 1932, I mean, it was one of the very first essays in French about Heidegger. So again, this is going to, you know, grab the attention of the French public. And the other thing that Fondin was able to do with Chestov's philosophy, he was able to take the essence of it. You know, he was able to distill it and express it, you know, through his approach to Heidegger, his approach to Kierkegaard, so that, you know, he could convey what he took to be the essential of Chestov's philosophy without having to elaborate it on its own and at length, which was the problem with Chestov. Albert Camus, he was also really influenced by Chestov, but in one place he refers to Chestov's body of work as possessing an admirable monotony. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was a bit of a drawback for Chestov, is that his books tend to say the same thing over and over and over again. That's a lot less true for Fondin, because he's bringing more to the table. There's also his engagement with Dadaism and Surrealism and other theories of poetry that he brings as well. So his 1938 book, Pseudo-Treatise of Aesthetics, he's very much engaged in a debate and a polemic with the Surrealists about the nature of poetry, and he's influenced by the Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce, who wrote a famous book on aesthetics. And he has his philosophical influences from before he met Chestov, including this guy, Jules de Gaultier, who was one of the early French interpreters of Nietzsche's philosophy. And Jules de Gaultier says, we all construct these illusions about ourselves and about other people and about society. We're all a bit like, you know, Flaubert's character, Charles Bovary. He calls it Bovaryism. You know, we're all kind of deceived about ourselves and others and society. And that also influences Fondin. So he's got his own thing that he brings to Chestov's philosophy that makes it more variegated, you know, more interesting. Now, in terms of the central idea that he takes from Chestov, that idea is that logic must be overthrown, that logic and reason exercise a kind of tyranny over the human being, which is not to say that we're supposed to throw out logic and reason and science altogether. It's just that these things have taken on a totalizing, dominating role in thought. There are certain areas of human experience that cannot be captured by logic or some rational way of thinking. And again, this is where Fondin's background as a poet comes into it. You know, there's a different kind of thinking, a more poetic, more creative thinking, which is able to express these elements of individual human existence, you know, the passions that we have and even, you know, our sensations and our sense impressions, which, you know, are kind of fleeting and transitory and have their own kind of intensities. Logic and reason want to, you know, reduce those to universal categories, you know, so that green is green is green is green. But for the poet, there's the greening of the leaf and the, you know, There's the green of the grass that the cows are grazing on. They're all of these, you know, different greens with all of their particular subtleties and textures. And then there's, you know, the experience, the person experiencing that green. And so the green isn't so much of a quality of or a thing, it's more of an event, you know, as Fondin says, the greening of the leaf, not the green. So there's this attempt to break out of these static, all-encompassing, universal, logical categories, and to think about things and about human life in terms of processes and developments, and in terms of the kind of vital forces and instinctual forces and unconscious forces that can't be understood or captured by logical thinking, and that, you know, in many instances are opposed to logical thought. So there's this kind of war or conflict within each individual human being between the logical side, you know, with its universal categories, and the irrational, unconscious, passionate side, you know, which is much more individual.
So why don't you tell us a bit about the selection of the pieces that you chose to translate and include in this book? So I should just perhaps begin by asking you, there isn't much Fondin translated into English. And so perhaps you can clarify that or contextualize that for us.
There haven't been any books of Fondin's works published in English until now. And last year, NYRB Classics, New York Review of Books Classics, published two books, mine, Existential Monday, and another one called Cinepoems, edited by Leonard Schwartz, with contributions from a whole lot of different people. And, you know, that's a book of Fondin's poetry. So these are the first major publications of Fondin in English, you know, the first collections of just Fondin and nothing but Fondin and a whole book. And up until then, you know, you have bits and pieces of Fondin published, you know, sometimes in literary journals. I think, you know, there's an excerpt from Fondin's book, Baudelaire and the Abyss, that was published in the Partisan Review, you know, like in 1946, you know, so bits and pieces here and there, but these are the first books to, you know, feature Fondin in English. So sorry, what was
that? No, that's great. So what about the selection of the...
The selection, yeah. Well, Existential Monday and the Sunday of History, that's the title essay of the book. And I picked that one because for a lot of people, including me, that essay is really the epitome of Fondin's philosophy. It's, you know, it's the summation, as some people like Olivier Salazar Ferrar put it, you know, it's his philosophical testament. And I think it's a really good introduction to Fondin's thought, because in this essay, which he wrote in early 1944, he contrasts the kind of new wave of existentialism, people like Heidegger, but also, you know, Sartre and Camus. He contrasts those people with the original existentialists, what he takes to be the original existentialists. And that is to say Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, in the English-speaking world, we don't often think of him as a philosopher, but Chestov is a Russian. Of course, he thinks of Dostoevsky as being a philosopher, not just a novelist. So Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, and Chestov, these are the original and authentic existentialists. And he also looks at other figures in the past that he sees as being part of that tradition, like Pascal, you know, who famously says that the heart has its reasons that reason knows not of. And Tertullian, early Christian writer who also famously or infamously said credo quia absurdum. It's not what he actually said, but that's the slogan that people take from Tertullian, which means I believe it because it's absurd. So these are, you know, one group of thinkers, and these original existentialists, they're not rationalists. They don't think that reason can solve everything, that can tell us everything. And as a matter of fact, according to Fondane and Chesthouse's interpretation, they are anti-rationalists. They are opponents of reason. And reason for all of these philosophers is also the enemy of freedom, because reason tells you that certain things are and they must be just the way they are, so that a triangle, you know, must have three sides, no more, no less. 2 + 2 must equal 4, not 5 or 3. So there's this rational necessity, and that can get applied in the moral sphere, as, for example, in Immanuel Kant's philosophy, act only according to a maxim that could serve as a universal law, you know, Kant's categorical imperative. All of that is constraining human freedom. And human freedom is, and this is coming more from Kierkegaard and Dostoevsky, it's choice. It's when you make a passionate choice, a passionate decision that cannot be rationally explained or rationally justified. So those are the authentic existential thinkers. And then there are the existentialists, right? This is the new thing, existentialism. That's a term that only comes about in the 1930s. And, you know, that's Heidegger and Sartre and to a lesser degree, Camus. And the problem with Heidegger and Sartre for Fondane is that they want to take all these insights from the existential thinkers, especially from Kierkegaard, and they want to use that to construct a new rational, logical system. They want to have a system of existence, you know, and Heidegger's, you know, existential categories, what he calls, you know, existentialia. You know, that's this for Fondane is just nonsense. And he sees both of them as capitulating to logic and to reason and to logical necessity. He takes particular exception to Heidegger's idea that freedom is freedom for death. I mean, this is one of the things that Heidegger talks about in Being and Nothingness, is that when we confront our own mortality and realize the inevitability of our end, that's when we actually become free. And Fondane says, nonsense. Real freedom would be freedom from death, from the necessity of having to die. And, you know, in Sartre's case, he says, you know, Sartre, you know, he's a bright young fellow, but he's read too much Hegel. He's confused Kierkegaardian, you know, nothingness and freedom. He's confused that with Hegelian nothingness and negation. And Hegelian negation is part of a logical system where you have something that you posit as a thesis, and then you have the negation of it or the antithesis. And then somehow reason reconciles those two opposed terms in an all-encompassing rational synthesis. And it's that all-encompassing rational synthesis that Fondane is particularly opposed to, because he says what looks like a synthesis really means that reason wins, and anything that reason can't understand, anything that it can't explain, our passions, our sensations, the fleeting transitory experiences that make up most of our subjective life, all of that gets thrown away or suppressed.
Can you tell us a bit about the other two essays?
One of the essays is particularly interesting. It was published in 1939, and it was after the Munich crisis of 1938, but before the outbreak of war in September 1939. And it's called The Sound and the Fury, or Man Before History. So he's writing about the crisis in Europe, the rise of Nazism and fascism. There's, you know, the civil war is raging in Spain between the Republicans and Franco's fascists, who are backed up by Mussolini and Hitler. The Nazis, you know, they're on the rise in Germany. They've taken over the Sudetenland. They had already taken over Austria in 1938. And then there's Mussolini in Italy and his fascism. So you know, Europe and the liberal democracies are being menaced by the rise of fascism. And there was an issue of a French periodical, Cahiers du Sud, that comes out of Marseille. And it was dealing with this crisis. And Fondane's is the final essay in the issue. And he takes kind of an overview, a survey of all the other essays. And he looks at the crisis as a whole. And he says, you know, some people are saying that the crisis means that we need to go back to our traditional values, in particular, the values of Catholicism. And medieval, some medieval version of Catholicism. And for Fondin, that's just not on for any number of reasons. But he doesn't, you know, even talk about that one very much. But a lot of the people who contributed, you know, Marxists and liberal thinkers say that, well, Nazism is this kind of irrationality. It's a kind of irrationalism. And so what we need is more reason. We've got to use reason to combat, you know, this kind of unreason. You know, not unlike, you know, what some people are saying now about, you know, President Trump in the United States. You know, there's all this irrationality and nonsense, and we need, you know, reason and knowledge to combat that. And Fondin says, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. Reason is not the solution. Reason is, in fact, the problem. He says that Hitler isn't just reasonable, he's reason himself in person. And by that, he means that Hitler is the embodiment of the kind of imperialism of reason, its tendency to dominate everything, its tendency to eliminate anything individual, irrational that stands in its way. You know, Fondin says, let's not go that way. And, you know, what does reason tell us to do? Well, reason, ever since the ancient Greeks, has said that, you know, the real individual, that's your mind. And it's the rational part of the mind. It's the intellect. So the separate intellect, you know, that can be immortal, says Aristotle. So you know, focus on that. And then you can be indifferent to the sufferings of the body. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of physical pain and torture you undergo. And Fondin says, well, that's ridiculous. That just becomes an excuse for all of the, you know, the suffering of living embodied individuals and their material deprivation and the torture and imprisonment. And Fondin says, no, we can't say that. You know, we can't, you know, legitimize this kind of suffering through the idea that somehow it doesn't matter, because the only part of yourself that counts is this rational intellectual part. So it's a very curious essay. I mean, it's got all of these tensions in it. But, you know, what's particularly striking about it is that he's looking over at Hitler, and everybody's, you know, saying that Nazism is a kind of irrationalism. Fondin's philosophy is also irrationalist, and so he's having to distinguish his kind of irrationalism, which is all in favor of the individual and the suffering of the individual, and trying to arrive at some comprehension of the individual suffering from the inside. He's trying to contrast that from Hitler's irrationalism, which Fondin says in his pseudo-treatise of aesthetics is irrationalism put to rational use. That, you know, Hitler's got all these things about, you know, blood and race and myth, and yes, it's all irrational, but actually it's all part of a very rationally worked out and strategic program of domination.
Interesting. You have also chosen to include an essay on boredom.
Yes. Now, this essay on boredom was part of Fondin's book about Baudelaire and the experience of the abyss. And in it, Fondin is trying to come to grips with boredom as a modern phenomenon. And he looks at Baudelaire's poetry as being one of the first expressions of this modern kind of boredom. And says, you know, this modern kind of boredom, it's not just, you know, oh, I don't have anything to do. It's not like your kids on spring break, you know, oh, you know, I'm bored, you know, nothing to do. It's something more profound. It's something which is actually, you know, metaphysical, and it's something that arises out of this modern civilization where things have really become a lot more rational in a lot of ways. I mean, you've got science, you've got technology, you've got a kind of government which is trying to organize itself on rational or scientific principles, with the civil service or a bureaucracy. You have this kind of rationalization of modern life that Max Weber also talks about. And in this kind of modern existence, it seems that for the individual, there's no longer anything left to do, really. There's nothing significant. This is something that Dostoevsky talks about in his Notes from Underground. And so we feel this boredom, which is a feeling of the insignificance of our own lives. and we don't have any reason for doing anything. So then what do? Well, we have to resort to stimulants. And, you know, Baudelaire, you know, notoriously his stimulants were hashish and opium, these artificial paradises, as Baudelaire called them. So there's that kind of thing. But then there's also cruelty. Cruelty is a stimulant. So, you know, Cleopatra, something that Dostoevsky talks about, you know, Cleopatra sticks, you know, pins into the breasts of her slaves, you know, in order to hear them scream. And Fondane also says, yeah, you know, and you might want to actually stick pins into your own breast because, you know, pain, that kind of suffering, it gives you some kind of consciousness of being alive. So in this modern age where everything is so regulated, everything is so rationally ordered, and you no longer have any passion, there doesn't seem to be any reason for doing anything, individuals and whole societies can find themselves in need of these stimulants, including cruelty and the infliction of suffering either on other people or on themselves. And it's this sort of thing that Fondane says that can lead to war, modern warfare.
Fondane, as you relate in the introduction, had a very tragic end to his life. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. He had a tragic end to his life. And I want to say right from the start here is that I don't like it when people overemphasize that. I think Fondane should be known for his ideas rather than his tragic ending. But he was turned into the French authorities, the collaborationist French police, in March of 1944. He was arrested, and then he was taken to a French camp, Drancy, which is just outside of Paris, and that's kind of a holding camp for people who are then going to be, you know, deported further east, you know, off to the concentration camps in Germany and Poland. And a lot of people tried to secure his release. Jean Paulhan, the editor of the Nouvelle Revue Française prior to the war, he got a lot of people together. And Emile Cirouan, the Romanian writer, got a bunch of Romanians together, including the Romanian delegate general to France at the time, which was Eugène Ionesco. So that they got these petitions together, and they took them to the German legation, they took them to the French police, and they were able to secure an agreement that Fondane could be released. But Fondane says, okay, but on condition that my sister, Lene, is released with me, because Fondane and his sister, Lene, they lived together in the same apartment. They were both arrested at the same time. Well, the authorities refused to release Fondane's sister. After all, you know, she was nobody. Nobody. She wasn't a literary personality the way Fondane was. So Fondane and his sister, Lene, they were both shipped out from Drancy to Auschwitz. And in October 1944, he was gashed at Auschwitz, Birkenau.
He was taken, you were saying, on the second last train.
Yes, the second last convoy from France to Auschwitz.
And he died something like a week or 2 weeks before the camp was liberated.
I was wrong about that. That's what I said in my introduction,
okay.
And I've been corrected about that since. But no, Auschwitz wasn't liberated until 1945. Yeah, you know, he was taken to Auschwitz, and there are testimonies from different people about what he was like in Auschwitz. Apparently, he was still engaging everybody in conversation. Fondane was a talker. He loved to talk. He loved to visit with people. People would come to his apartment, and he'd talk and talk and talk with them. You know, Cioran talks about this, and and other people as well. And he just kept on talking about philosophy and poetry while he was in Auschwitz. Apparently, he wrote poetry in Auschwitz, but unfortunately, but naturally, that poetry is lost. Some people describe him as offering, you know, kind of comfort to other prisoners, you know, in Auschwitz. So it seems that he remained very much himself, even in Auschwitz. Before he was captured, he had written to his wife Genevieve. This was earlier on in the war, and he said, you know, this war is going to be a chance to see whether I can actually live this existential philosophy. This war is going to be a test of this existential philosophy. And I think that as far as was humanly possible, he did exactly that. He did live his philosophy. And I think to that extent, you know, Henri Lefebvre was right, you know, that Fondane was somebody who lived his philosophy and went to the limit of his philosophy.
Near the end of the introduction, you write about the contemporary significance of Fondane. You write, his work seems to leapfrog over the post-war era to join with ours, bypassing the preoccupations of the post-war phenomenological existentialists. It links up with the critique of reason and of the unified I found in such postmodern thinkers as Deleuze and Derrida. Fondane's search for the impossible, for the possible beyond all logical possibility, anticipates Foucault and Alain Badiou. His distrust of ideologies and abstractions, his passion for individual and concrete existence, his ceaseless questioning and searching all speak to our post-utopian disenchanted world. Do you want to expand on that?
Sure. Well, first of all, to start with ideologies. I mean, Fondane's critique of ideologies, you know, of Marxism and of fascism, but of anything that wants to set itself up as a, you know, some kind of universalizing ideology. I mean, he was articulating that critique in the 1930s, and it wasn't really until the 1950s, you know, people like Hannah Arendt, you know, The Origins of Totalitarianism, you know, developed arguments along very similar lines, or Sigmund Bauman, you know, the sociologist. So I think in that way, a lot of Fondane's critique was very prescient. Mm-hmm. This anti-totalitarian thinking that he was already developing, an anti-ideological thinking, in his Rambo the Hooligan, I'll call it that, Rambo le Voyou. He has this one line where he says, you know, there isn't an idea, and he has it with a capital I, that doesn't have 1,000 murders on its conscience. Hmm. You know, that people will do all these things in the name of an idea, forgetting about the actual living human individuals who are going to be sacrificed for that idea. So there's that about him. And then there is that, you know, distrust or that, you know, critique of reason. Gilles Deleuze is also influenced by Shestov, and you know, Deleuze takes this up in his first important book, his one on Nietzsche and philosophy in 1962. And, you know, very much like Shestov, whom Deleuze references, and like Fondane, he opposes, you know, the living being to the rational being, or what reason would make of that rational being. And Fondane also, you know, very much anticipating Foucault, talks about, and Derrida talks about, you know, the role of reason as this kind of, you know, policing agent, that reason is surveilling, you know, all of our activities and all of our thoughts. And anybody who goes against its dictates is either going to be, you know, thrown into jail, or, you know, cast out of society. So, you know, there are a lot of things in there that are similar to the argument that Foucault develops in his Madness and Civilization, or The History of Madness. Getting, you know, away from, you know, beyond phenomenology, You know, again, in that respect, I think he's very much like Foucault and also like, you know, Deleuze. They want to have a different approach to these philosophical problems. They think that phenomenology and phenomenological existentialism make way too many concessions to reason, to the neglect of, you know, that wilder, you know, more irrational side of human existence. So, you know, that they bring, you know, people like Nietzsche back into the picture, Freud, and, you know, depending on what time period we're talking about, Marx, you know, trying to reconnect philosophy to these vital sort of forces within us and to, you know, the material aspects of human existence. And I think that, you know, Fondin is a much better fit with that, is much more compatible with that than, you know, Sartre and Beauvoir and Merleau-Ponty. I've written one essay about this, comparing Fondin and Chestov and Deleuze on the figure of the private thinker. That's a phrase that comes from Kierkegaard. In Kierkegaard's book Repetition, he makes a contrast between the public philosopher, Hegel, who's state-appointed and is really a spokesperson for state ideology, and the private thinker. And the private thinker that Kierkegaard refers to is Job. You know, and there's Job, who's lost everything, you know, all of his cattle, all of his wealth and possessions, and his family, you know, his wife and all of his children, they've all been taken away from him. And Kierkegaard says, well, if you really want to understand something about human existence, go to Job rather than Hegel. And that's a theme that Chestov develops and that Deleuze picks up on as well. So you know, the whole existential phenomenological period, to which, by the way, I'm very attached myself. I mean, as you said, I was one of the editors of Sartre Studies International for a decade. But that whole period, you know, can perhaps be regarded as a parenthesis. And then there's this link, you know, between some of the thinkers of the 1930s and the thinkers who start to come to prominence in the 1960s, like Deleuze and Foucault and Derrida.
So, Bruce, maybe to wrap up, you can tell us very briefly about where you've gone since working on this book.
I've gone really in two directions. One is to take this critique of logic and of logical necessity and to examine that more closely and in more depth. That's something that I'm working on right now. So going back to Aristotle, I'm going back to, you know, Aristotle's discussions of necessity in Book 5 of Metaphysics. Looking at, you know, why is it that logical necessity seems to be the most necessary kind of necessity, rather than vital necessity, existential necessity, or material necessity. So, you know, I want to look at these different senses of necessity, the existential necessity that has to do with what you need to do in order to live your own life. That's something developed by Chestov and Fondin. Then there's, you know, the idea of material necessity that Marx talks about in Capital. He has this contrast, you know, the realm of necessity and the realm of freedom. So as long as we're governed by necessity, then we're not free. There's that whole line that I want to look at and develop, which goes contrary to the philosophical lineage from Kant. You know, Kant says obedience to a law one gives oneself is perfect freedom. If that law, you know, comes from reason. So obeying rational necessity is freedom. And other people who sort of build on that tradition, including, you know, to some extent, people like Sartre, you know. So there are those two opposed sides that I want to look at. The other thing that I'm working on, and this is only tangentially related to Fondin, is walking. Walking in philosophy, that's something that I started working on in a serious way about the same time that I started the project of translating Fondin into English. And so that's looking at walking as embodied experience, you know, embodied consciousness. My joke is that, you know, in 1637, Descartes invented the mind-body problem. philosophers have been trying to solve it ever since. But the problem is that most of their thinking about it has been done while they've been sitting down, right? And if you get up and start walking, then the relations between mind and body become a lot clearer to you. So I've been developing something about that in relation to Descartes. I did a walk near Digne-les-Bains, which is the home of Pierre Gassendi, who said in response to Descartes, "I think, therefore I am. I walk, therefore I am. Ambulo ergo sum." I've walked in Nietzsche's footsteps in Sils Marie in Switzerland, the place where he had his vision of the eternal return of the same. I walked in Samuel Taylor Coleridge's footsteps in Somerset in England, trying to get an idea of the connection between Coleridge's walking through that countryside and his poetic imagination. So there are all these different ways of exploring different aspects of mind in relation to the body, in relation to how they're embodied, as that comes out in walking in particular. So looking at walking is the sort of key experience that shed some light on all these questions.
Well, that's terrific, Bruce. I look forward to reading those pieces. And I want to thank you for taking the time out to chat with me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks very much, Robert.
Thank you.